You're listening to Through the Dark Woods podcast, and I'm your host, Josiah Tamira Crossley. If you're looking for support to work with your own grief or training in how to support others through grief and trauma, or would like to find out more about our amazing online community, check out darkwoodsofgrief.com. Okay, so I am here today with an old friend, Silvia de Blasio. Silvia was born and raised in Argentina, and she left along with her refugee parents and siblings and lived in Venezuela for 25 years before immigrating to Canada. She's a psychopedagogist by trade, and she worked in Canada for 10 years as an employment counselor and coach for refugees and immigrants. She currently works for three different organizations: Gaia Education, the Work That Reconnects Network, and the Capra Course by Fritjof Capra, where she has different roles from online courses coordinator to facilitator. And I forget how we met, but we met like somehow through our work like years ago. And I reached out to Silvia because I wanted to speak with someone to offer a perspective on the unique grief that one faces as an immigrant coming from, you know, leaving your homeland and coming to a new place. And I think this is just so often overlooked, perhaps by those of us who haven't had that experience. And then it's not just not something that's talked about a lot. And yeah, there's a few different reasons why I'm interested in it. One, just to bring more awareness to folks who aren't aware of this experience. Two, to, you know, offer some support and kind of maybe like the word is coming as refuge for people who are having that same experience and haven't heard it talked about much, right? And then the third one is so many of us who don't have that experience currently in our lives have that in our ancestry, right? And so I think we have that grief in our ancestry, but we're very unaware of it. It's kind of gone underground because it's been a few generations or that kind of thing. So I'm super excited to have you here today, Silvia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you, Josiah, for having me. And yeah, this is a great topic that is not usually discussed. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think with mass migrations becoming kind of a pattern of the future, you know, a lot of people leaving their countries for different reasons, you know, from war to climate change to, you know, other things. I think we're going to see more and more of that grief circulating, you know, apart from all the other grief that, you know, we all carry for so many other reasons. So thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really agree with you. I mean, it's been huge, and it's just getting bigger and bigger. It feels like almost by the hour, you know, these days, just so much crisis happening in the world for all different reasons, and people needing to seek refuge, and it being a, you know, an incredibly challenging process a lot of the time. So I know a little bit of the history of Argentina, but not great detail. But so I want to ask you maybe to give us a little bit of the background of like, why did you have to leave Argentina?
Yeah, thank you. Well, first, I want to give some, you know, some context about the type of migration that people may experience before going into Argentina and my own story. So some people, you know, migrate because they are looking for a better life. So they're not necessarily running away from, you know, something that is, you know, wrong or broken for them. And, you know, that it's not that it's not grief, but, you know, obviously it's different, you know, because it's a choice.
Yeah.
And some people migrate because there's no other choice. You know, if they stay, they may be killed or they may be persecuted or they may experience, you know, a lot of challenges in, you know, in their home countries.
Yeah.
So that's a different type of grief, obviously. So now we're going back to your question, you know, Argentina, same as many other countries in Latin America, had experienced a lot of coup d'etat, you know, like when the military take the power, because usually there is some situation that they think that they're going to fix, or some part of the, you know, the population think that that is going to be the fix of the situation, you know, putting somebody by force.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not new. And actually when that happened in Argentina in 1976, there was another coup d'etat prior to that in Chile. So it was kind of a cascade of coup d'etats. So many of those were kind of supported and even orchestrated by other forces, you know, foreign forces that had some interest there.
Like
so in,
the
in
US.
like the US, yeah. You know, so actually that's very known today as the Condor project or something like that. Is, you know, it has the Condor name. I don't remember exactly the name.
Yeah.
But it was a sort of project that they had. Okay, if you know, if we support these forces that are already emerging in these countries, the countries are going to need this and this and that. So it was a technique that they utilized and continue to utilize in some countries to bring liberalism and, you know, and basically sell the country to whoever, you know, wants
it's
to
economic.
Buy.
It's all economic.
It's an economic and also political, because, you know, Argentina was a very strong country years ago. During the Second War was called the Granero del Mundo, which translates some kind of the place where everybody was going for meat and for food, because was kind of the only functioning country during the World War II that could produce what Europe needed, because Europe was completely destroyed by the war, right? So Argentina got a lot of money and, you know, was super powerful. And that was the time, and even before that, when Argentina became a country that was in many ways mimicking, you know, the architecture and the organizations, the structure, everything mimicking what was in Europe already, right? So it was considered an advanced country in Latin America. But by 1976, that changed. I'm not going to go into the whole history and politics. But what happened was that this government, this military government that came in, was really aggressive, and specifically aggressive to those who oppose their worldview, and specifically to, you know, what they call the communists. And I say what they call because some of them were communists and some of them were just liberal people who wanted a different way, you know, for their children, for their families. So they put everybody in the same, you know, in the same pot and say, okay, these are people we don't want here. And they started torturing and killing people. They actually said publicly that anybody over the age 6 was already indoctrinated in those, you know, ideas that they didn't like. So anybody above age of 6 will need to, you know, go, same as their parents and, you know, any other part of the family. And what they did was that anybody below the age of 6, they actually kidnapped these kids and send them, some of them to families who wanted children and the elites, and some of them outside of Argentina. That caused a huge how to say that, you know, it's a wound that I don't know is going to take hundreds of years to heal for Argentinians, because even today there are people who don't know who their parents, you know, are, or people who know who their parents are because of the DNA and all the other things that, you know, and there are organizations right now helping people who were kidnapped at that time when they were babies, their parents killed, you know, and trying to put them together with at least the grandmas or, you know, any other part of the family. But the families are broken. And that's when, as a result of that, of what happened in Argentina, not just a lot of people were brutally killed and tortured, or we call the desaparecidos, so the people who disappear, because for many years, nobody knew what happened to them until things started to emerge. There was a lot of fear, you know, a lot of anger, but mostly fear in families. I actually had to stay behind. I couldn't travel with my mom. My mom, you know, had to change her identity, even physically, to get out of the country, because she was in the list, in the blacklist. So she went away with my siblings. I stay, you know, in the country because they couldn't find my father to give the authorization. I was from a different father. So I traveled 3 years after that. So I actually lived through the things that happened after my mom left. You know, the continuous fear of telling your real name or saying who you are, not knowing where your parents are, not knowing what is going to happen to you, you know. And I had to leave. I was, you know, when she left, I was 10. So I lived the most important years in a woman. Yeah. You know, I lived those with my grandma, who was not necessarily prepared to, you know, and she was a scare as well, and, you know, had a lot of issues around what was going to happen to her daughter. And, you know, so it was a lot of those things around me until I finally could go to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I hated Venezuela, but not because Venezuela was something bad or anything. It was because I didn't choose. You know, yeah. I didn't, as a child, you know, that was not my choice. I didn't want to leave my country.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to see my mom and my siblings, but I didn't want to leave my country and my grandma. And so that's basically the, you know, the picture of what happened at that time. I carry a sort of guilt, which I have been told by other Argentinians that carry more or less the same, which is the survivor guilt, you know, feeling that, oh, you know, some of my friends didn't survive, or some of my friends' parents didn't survive. So I'm kind of carry that, and I don't know what to do with that, to be honest. And, you know, I mean, I mentally I know, but emotionally is, you know, sometimes emerges when in my worst moments that emerges again.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, well, it's definitely a form of trauma, right? Heavy trauma, like, absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I think I didn't, I'm like just now, like, fully receiving the story of what happened there. You know, I had some ideas, but just to hear it from you and hear your personal experience, it's like the weight of it is landing with me, and I'm sure also with our listeners. And yeah, I just want to say that I'm so sorry that you went through that and that happened, and also that I know it's such a common experience in the world today. You know, so many people have lived a similar story. So thank you for sharing, you know, the courage to share.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. So you went to Venezuela and then you were there for 25 years. And is that you met your husband in Venezuela? Yes.
Yeah, I met my husband there, married there, had my children there. So, but I always carry this thing that Venezuela wasn't my choice. My mom, you know, my mom came back to Argentina with my siblings, which they were all younger than me. So she came back to Argentina once the situation kind
shifted.
Of improved, or yeah, changed into a democracy. It was very difficult for her, very difficult for my siblings. I decided not to come back because I was hurt. You know, it was weird because the thing that I most wanted in my teenage years that I remember was to come back to Argentina. So when this door opened and I could come back, I didn't want to. It's a weird thing, you know. It's partially because of the relationship with my mom was already broken because of all this trauma. It was very difficult. So I was 17 and I decided to stay all by myself in Venezuela with nobody, no family, no friends, nothing.
Wow.
But for me, that was a better choice at that time than coming back to Argentina with my mom. And in many ways, I think that I made the right choice, because my siblings and my mom, you know, they went to an Argentina that was broken, very broken. So the opportunities were really low. And they have stayed, as you know, in poverty since they came back. And yeah, and that's another guilt that I carry, you know, that I, but in a way I have acknowledged and embraced that guilt, being now the supporter financially of my family back home.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm the only one who's, you know, in a better situation financially to help, which is a good thing, right? So in everything, you know, there's good and bad things. I don't know. I don't know how to say, but, and it will be really bad to say that the coup d'etat was a, you know, it was never a good thing. But in a way, going through all that situation, I think that it shaped me in the ways that I'm right now, and it makes me understand much better the situation with other people. It makes me even less like, I love my country, but I'm not attached to that, you know, like other people, that is my country. And you know, it's, I'm not attached. I'm more attached to the earth as a whole,
yeah,
right? Than to a country as a national thing, like, you know, as a,
yeah,
as an identity or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Which in a way is a more real connection, to be connected directly to the earth and the land where you are. And I'm sure there's still, I would guess, I'm curious if there's, do you feel like, because the land here is so different than both Venezuela and Argentina, do you feel like that, do you like, do you have, do you miss that land specifically still, or do you
yeah,
feel like...
it's that's a question that I haven't, I, okay, so I'm gonna share you know, something that is probably very, very mine, and not necessarily other people may feel the same way. But it's funny, but Canada, and specifically British Columbia, in many ways resembles, you know, the south of Argentina. I wasn't born in Buenos Aires, which is the capital. I was born in Bahía Blanca. That city is called the door to the Patagonia, right? And the Patagonia and British Columbia had many resemblances, and not in all the landscapes. People think that Patagonia is just one landscape, and it's not, it's many. But there is a part of Patagonia that is very similar to British Columbia, in the type of trees or forests, in the type of the climate, right? There is a lot of water there. The difference is that, you know, in the part that I'm referring to is more lakes, you know, and rivers, not so much, because it's not, it's close to the Andes and not too, not close to the sea, right? So in many ways, when I came to Canada, I was like, oh, you know, looking at everything, I was, these are the same flowers, dandelions are here too.
Wow.
And you know,
cool.
And
yeah.
And the pines, you know, and the, you know, at that time I was calling pines anything that resembles a, you know,
yeah,
a
yeah,
conifer,
just,
you know,
the, yeah, evergreen.
Yeah, and,
yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, they are so similar, right? And another thing that happened is that here I felt that the land actually welcomed me from the beginning. It was, you know, it was a feeling that I'm home, I'm safe, you know, and this land is so beautiful and so welcoming. While in Venezuela, I didn't feel that, but I think it has nothing to do with the land. The landscape was very different in Venezuela because it's a Caribbean country, so the climate is different. You know, in Argentina, we have warmer climate in the north, but I have never been into the north. So it was a different climate from what I experienced. It was a different vegetation. It's more, you know, yeah, it's more Caribbean. It has a lot of, you know, ocean and, you know, heat and all that. And the people are a little bit different, you know, more Caribbean style, you know, more fun and, you know, smiles.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah. And for me, that I was coming all broken inside, not wanting to leave, you know, it, I didn't feel welcome there. But it, like I say, it doesn't have anything to do with the land. I think it was my own process, internal process, that wouldn't allow me to receive anything from the land or from the people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's so interesting. I really resonate with, like, because my ancestors, I've never been back to Ireland and England, but my ancestry is primarily from there. And there is a sense of, like, when I'm in certain places here, like particularly on Salt Spring, where there's, the rolling fields, and like I get this feeling, like I'm like, oh, this is like somehow familiar to me, and I feel like simultaneously grief but also comfortable in those. So I think our bodies remember, even if we haven't been to these places. So I love that you were able to find that welcoming here, and to like resource, finding resource here. Yeah. And
It's
you, oh, go ahead. Yeah.
no, I was going to say that it's, Canada, is different in other ways, even when Canada and Argentina, in terms of the colonization, have more or less the same age, because the people, the colonizers came here more or less at the same time that the Spaniards came to Argentina, right? But the history of Argentina is more, I would say that it's a little bit more complex, because it started a little bit earlier, the colonization, in terms of building things and, and changing things. The indigenous people in the places where they have cities in Argentina were completely displaced, right? But at the same time, the way that the Spaniards worked with indigenous people was a little bit different. So they were also the ones who were not displaced or killed, they were integrated eventually. So a lot of, if you go to Argentina, you're gonna see that most people are a mix, of different ethnicities. So in that way, it's different. It's different in the structures. In Canada, you don't feel the history, because there's few buildings or things that represent, centuries. But in Argentina, you do. And it's very heavy. I mean, Argentina has the, just giving you an idea, the buildings were built resembling those in Paris, in France. And so the architecture in Argentina is very similar to the European architecture. So in some places you feel that, where am I? Am I in Buenos Aires, or am I in Paris, or any other European city? The other thing is that things like the metro, the this the equivalent to the SkyTrain here, is the first one in the whole America,
Oh, wow.
and so the first time that I came back to Argentina, I actually sat in the same, how do you call that, the same seats and the same structures where people had sat in 1905, so it's crazy.
More
So
somewhere.
you feel it, yeah. So you feel the history everywhere, because the materials that they use to build the things are more durable, so they stay for longer. In Canada, there's a lot of wood use, right? There is a lot of, stone, and so you feel that. So that's something that is both, it's confusing for somebody who comes from a lot of history that, kind of weighs on you when you come to Canada, but at the same time it's liberating. It's like, oh, and that it's history in Canada, obviously, the indigenous people have been here for centuries, but it's the feeling of actually seeing it, the seeing the structure, seeing the things there, the structures in front of you. But not seeing those here, it feels both that you are not contained, and at the same time, it's a freedom. So you know, if you're in a good day, you say, oh, I can do anything here because it's, you know, it's kind of open, right? But in a bad day, you feel that there's no container, there's no history, there's nothing to back you up, right? So it feels, that's another type of grief.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, wow. And you worked for 10 years as an employment counselor and a coach for refugees and immigrants. And so did you see like a lot of kind of similar stories, but from different places or, you know, what did you, I'm curious about what you saw and learned, and then also how your experience kind of helped you in that work.
Yeah, so when I came here, I want to share first, you know, that I couldn't work right away, which is the experience of many immigrants and refugees, not just because of the language, which is a barrier, obviously. And, you know, you can't complain. And, you know, if you don't speak the language, what you're going to do, you need to learn the language. You know, there are not many jobs without the language. So that's a reality. I wouldn't say that it's a, you know, it's a barrier, but it's a reality. So, and you are, it's on the individual to learn the language. Nobody has the, you know, nobody owes you that, you know, that the language is not your language. But that was one of the things. I also was a mother of two small children. So it was very difficult to find that here there are not support systems like I had in Venezuela. There is very easy to find, you know, daycare, but also to have family around to care for the children. Daycare there is a very high quality daycare and very cheap at the same time. And here was the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's very, very expensive. And on the top of that, I was told to volunteer in order to gain Canadian experience. So I imagine, you know, you don't have money to pay for daycare, you're new, you desperately need a job. And the you know, the experts on looking for a job tell you, okay, you had to volunteer in order to, you know, gain Canadian experience because you don't have Canadian experience. So that's kind of dismissing completely what you were doing in your country as if that was not experience. So from that experience, I started to learn, and it's okay, I cannot do what I was doing there. I was teaching there, you know, I was working in schools and private schools. I was teaching children and I was working with special children. I was also working in computers and, you know, the integrating computers into special children's needs. Okay. And things like that. And I couldn't find anything here. So I said, well, I need to do something. You know, and I did what many immigrants do, which is you reinvent yourself. So I figure out that because nothing of what I have been doing, you know, would be recognized here easily, I started a new career. So I studied to become an employment counselor, and, you know, it's actually called in a different way. You basically offer services to immigrants and refugees, and one of the ways that you can offer that is through helping them to find employment and settle here. So it's a settlement counselor and employment counselor. So, and I wanted to do that because I say, you know what, I spent the first 4 years in Canada deeply, you know, depressed and thinking that I had made a huge mistake choosing to come to Canada, that all my career was gone, that, you know, I was, everything what I studied and wanted to do had completely disappeared and was not going to happen again, which is something that I saw that happened to mostly women, but also men who come to Canada and experience more or less the same, that they had to leave all this behind.
Yeah.
So I say, and you know what, I'm going to work with them because that's what I experienced and I don't want them to experience that.
Mm-hmm.
So I started, you know, I it was difficult, but I started a childcare in my house to support, you know, to, I say, well, if I had to pay for daycare, you know, better I do the daycare, you know, and I have my own children there. And in the evenings when the children were gone, my husband will stay with mine and I will go to study. Right. And that's how, you know, I funded my own career. And in 2008, 2008, I started working. I was lucky because, you know, having another language and other things, you know, gave me my first job, but it was very difficult. It was, you know, really, really difficult to even get the first job. So answering your questions, yes, I have seen that, you know, both in immigrants and refugees. And like I say, immigrants are the people who come here because they chose to come here. But the reason that they chose may be different. So, for example, a lot of people come here as students just because it's easier for them. It's like a door to get into, you know, the residence in Canada. Not necessarily because they want to study. So sometimes they sell their houses, sell everything what they have, and put all the money into studying something that they don't really care much, but it's the door to get into residency. So even when it was a choice, there's a lot of grief there. Because nobody wants to, nobody wants to sell their houses and all their, you know, things and getting themselves and their children sometimes into a situation that is very precarious, that you don't know if it's going to work, right? So it's a very difficult situation. Refugees are different because they're basically coming from very difficult situations where they didn't have a choice, you know. And the other thing is that, well, you probably know that, but there is a lot of corruption in the system, both immigrating and, you know, even how or who chooses, you know, who comes here as a refugee. So not all the refugees that we see are the refugees that are the most vulnerable. Actually, the most vulnerable never come. They stay in refugee camps forever. They are not eligible to come here or to anywhere, you know. So there is all that mixed up, which actually caused a burnout for me, because after 10 years trying to help people and finding that I was basically helping engineers and doctors and, you know, and teachers and people who were very well formed in their countries to work in Walmart, right? That was the option. It was very difficult to get somewhere else.
Like, why don't those skills? Like, what is happening that those skills don't aren't allowed?
There is a mismatch. There is a mismatch between what the government says that, you know, Canada needs and what actually is needed. And there is a mismatch because there is a lot of many employers don't have the education or the skills or the tools to receive people from other cultures, so they are scared of receiving somebody and not and having a mismatch. And I completely understand, you know, that sometimes, you know, you have a business and you don't know if this is going to work because you already have people. And you don't know if this nationality goes well with this nationality, which happens sometimes, right? And there's the barriers of the language, the barriers of, well, the ways that they were doing that in their countries are different from the ways here, but there's not much help, you know, that actually shares with them, okay, how are the ways here? It's not just volunteer, because you can volunteer for everything. You can volunteer as a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and volunteer as a doctor to show and see and learn how the things are here. And doctors actually is the one of the longest or more expensive ways, from your experience. So a doctor with 20 years of experience in their country comes here and needs to wait 6 years, 8 years sometimes to actually become a doctor, right? And has to pay a lot of courses that they are forced to take again. They had to do the residency, which is kind of what a recent graduate does. And the most residencies are in very rural areas, you know, that nobody wants to go there. So it's, and that is just one profession. Now, if I start telling you all the other professions, you start crying. But Yeah, but that's part of the grief of losing a career, you know, having your experience completely dismissed, right? Your language doesn't work anymore here. The flavors of the things, even if you can buy the things from, you know, your culture, the flavors are different. If you're lucky that you find the things from your country, then not just that you have to pay a lot of money, but also if you are aware, then you have the guilt that that travels so long, you know, from your country here. So, oh my, I'm eating plantain, but the plantain comes from this country and causes a lot of devastation. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, all those things. So there, all those are the things that I heard and also experienced from immigrants.
Wow. Okay, so I guess I'm curious, like, now I'm like, wow, it's like so much to live through, you know, and yet I see people like you and many people who make a beautiful life out of it, and I wouldn't know their story, you know, I wouldn't know all of that that they've been through because they do such an incredible job of making a beautiful life out of it. So what do you think are like, what do you think are the skills of resilience, or like what have you found that, you know, what have you had to do, and what has worked for you to, you know, create the beautiful life that you have, really? And I know, of course, there's still struggles, but what has worked for you, and what have you seen other people who actually like manage to find some form of thriving through that, or do they, do you see that ever?
Not everybody flourishes, right? A lot of people, actually, there are statistics. I don't have them right now on the top of my mind, but there are statistics of how many people actually stay and how many people, you know, come back. And a lot of people come back to their countries for different reasons, including financial or health, for example, because the healthcare here is very, you know, it's, the system is broken. So they prefer to go to their own countries to do all the things. We actually had a workshop when I was working with immigrants about what happened to couples and families. And the thing is that when you immigrate, whether it's for refugee or, you know, for choice as an immigrant, either families and couples, either they become stronger or they completely, you know, are broken by the process. And I think that that's obviously, you know, that has to do a lot with how they were before coming to here. But I think also has to be with the resilience skills that you're mentioning. You know, there are many factors. I would say that some of them are into your own making or your power because you have them inside. And a lot of people find the resilience in their own communities and, you know, having their, you know, their mosque or their church or their, you know, or their temple or just their groups, even if they don't practice anything, you know, having a group where they meet and they share food, they share stories, they share, you know, festivities and things that are common to their culture or their language. That's one of the things that I have seen that, you know, creates a lot of resilience. Not necessarily my case, because there are not many Argentinians here, and at least they were not when I came, and not many Venezuelans either. But also because I'm not very social. So I'm not the type of person that, you know, goes to, I went to a lot of meetings when my children were younger, but eventually it's not where I find, right? The most. So for me particularly has been that feeling that I mentioned before of feeling welcomed by the land. I actually started to look, where do I belong? And I started to approach different groups that were calling me beyond my nationality, beyond my language, beyond, you know, any identity, cultural or otherwise, we're calling more my humanity. We're calling more my connection with life. And that's how I ended up leaving the job with refugees and immigrants, because I was burned out and it was kind of in system. So kind of working for the system that was creating the issues that I wanted to solve. So it didn't make a lot of sense. So I started working in other organizations where, and it was not necessarily something that I planned. It was something that emerged as I was going into things like permaculture or regeneration or healing or herbalism, you know, the art of mentoring and all those things that I started exploring to see where I belong, right? So for me particularly, that was and continues to be the core of my resilience. But like I say, for others that I have witnessed, it has been the communities, you know, the cultural communities, the religious communities, you know, staying with the language at home, those kind of things.
And I've witnessed you in that journey of, you know, from, because when we met, you were still working at that job, and then I've just witnessed you grow that deep connection with the land. And I mean, you always had it since I met you anyways, and probably even much younger because of the way you even speak of feeling welcomed by the land when you came here, you know, but that witnessing of that, yeah, that deep connection with the land and gaining your resilience from that, that's so beautiful and powerful. And and in a way, I mean, it's interesting because I think like when we know our own history and know our own ancestry and story, like when we know our story, but then we also connect with the land where we are, there's something that's almost like repaired there in terms of like all the harm that's caused by these, yeah, forced immigration and even just the damage that, you know, the Western culture is doing to the earth herself.
Yeah, and there's something that I usually discuss with my children. We have spoken about that because they're Venezuelans. So for them, their belonging and their longing is different from mine. You know, they long for something that I don't, because I, you know, I'm from Argentina, my husband is from Venezuela, they are from Venezuela, and you know, those kind of things. And one thing that I always share with them is that once you are a refugee, you're never stopping being a refugee. Once you're an immigrant, you never stop being an immigrant. Even when you are received by the land and by the people, and I, to be honest, I have no bad experiences in Canada in many ways. You know, I don't have bad experiences like the ones that I have seen, you know, other or I have been told by other immigrants to have here. I have experienced some discrimination, but it has been not the center. And probably that has to be with the fact that I'm white, you know, and, you know, blue eyes. So it's kind of like, I can blend at least physically with, you know, but one thing that you carry all the time is that, I wouldn't say identity is something different from identity. It's like once you are broken or separated from the place where you belong, the place where you were born and the history of your family, and remembering, like you say before, that the family that was my family in Argentina came, you know, from Italy and Spain, so it's not necessarily that was all, you know, in Argentina. I mean, it has centuries in Argentina, but you know, you carry that in your DNA. You carry the pain from those other immigrants that come before you. But the thing is, as you as an individual, you are separated from that first land, from that first culture, and then you come to another land and you may be welcome, you may build a you know, a life that is perfect and that you don't want to move from there because you really like the people, you really like everything, but you're always from somewhere else that you cannot change that, right? And when you go back, and more if you are considering, you know, coming back because of whatever reason, you say, well, maybe I cannot stay here, you know, in my aging years, maybe for whatever reason, you know, I cannot stay here in Canada, then you'll realize that you're going to miss Canada. So you're always missing, right? So here in Canada, I miss Argentina. My children miss Venezuela. My husband missed Venezuela, right? If I move to Venezuela or Argentina, I'm going to miss Canada because now this is also part of my life. So that longing is going to be there forever. It's, you know, once you break, there's no way to fix it. There's no way to say, well, now you're Canadian and nothing is happening. No, you have carried that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think there is a solution for that.
No. Yeah.
It's just something that you have to carry.
It's a grief that you carry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you walk with it. Yeah, we have friends in Gaza, and they say, like, I mean, it's very difficult to, as you may know, it's very difficult to leave Gaza right now, almost impossible, like $5,000 a person to get across the border into Egypt. But also they say, like, our one friend, Mahmoud, he said, like, if I leave Palestine, then I'm forever a ref, you know, we're going to be forever refugees. So he said he would rather die than leave, you know. And it's like that depth of connection, the land, you know, of someone whose ancestry has been there like thousands and thousands of years, and like witnessing what they have there. It's like just through witnessing and becoming closer with them, it's been like, wow, like that's what we're missing, you know, all of us who have come from somewhere else or whose ancestors have come from somewhere else, like that depth of connection is so profound. And I think many of us will never even know that, you know, and so we just have to walk with the grief of that absence.
Yeah. And the thing is that if you come back, you know, like, you know, your friend, when they choose to not leave, it's probably because they know that when you come back, the place is not the same and you are not the same. So even if you are able to come back, you know, the place is not going to receive you the same way that, you know, you were accepted. I mean, when you were born there, you were accepted by default, let's say, right? By the culture and by the land. But once you come back, you are a completely different person now. So you're going to see the things with other eyes, and the things are going to be also different because the things have changed. All this time that you were away, things have changed. I grieve when I say, oh, I really miss, you know, Argentina. And people say, Sylvia, the Argentina you miss doesn't exist anymore. You know, that Argentina from the 70s is not there anymore. And if you think, it's normal, that applies to any place. You know, if you leave a place for so long, obviously that place is not going to be the same. It's, you know, it's going to change. And it's kind of the normal, you know, the normal thing of life, that, you know, things change and humans have moved or forced to be moved for, you know, all the time, for centuries. And I think we all carry that. We all carry that in our DNA, that we, and that's what I try to think when I feel a lot of pain about place, right? Or about culture, is remembering that we have been moving since the moment that we were humans for the first time and opened the eyes, or, you know, so we have been moving. We have been moving because the climate has changed in the past, because, you know, the icebergs have, you know, covered the earth and then numb, and or because of famine, or, you know, many different challenges that we experience as humans in the past, we always have been moving from one place to the other. Now the migration is massive. And now there's more complexity, you know, than before. And the other thing is that before we were moving as groups. We were not moving as families or as an individual.
Exactly.
It was very rare, you know, that even when people came from Europe to, you know, to Turtle Island, when they moved here and they were, you know, they were moving because of a need, like from Ireland or other places that were really starving, and coming here to look for, you know, a new life and food, they were coming in groups most, you know, and they were coming into groups as well. So they were settled in little places, you know, like all the Irish together, all the Italians together, all the Spaniards together. But now we see these individual, you know, families and individual people.
One family, yeah.
Right. So you're losing that connection. And like I say, you know, the only connection that we really have at the end of the day is with the earth. It's the only thing that hasn't moved. We haven't gone to another planet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We are still
yet.
Here.
Thank God.
No, yeah. No. No, please.
Yeah, exactly.
No, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the other thing I really was struck by with our friend in Gaza, is like, as I was like, oh, like saying to my friend who's in Florida, who's it's her family, and I was like, oh, you know, could we get them out, could we help them to get out? And then like the next day, one of them is like, oh, we took a picture of the whole family and it's like 40 people. You know, it's like, right. Whoa, like that's how far, you know, my family is disconnected from what family is, you know, because one of my ancestors, my Irish ancestor, did come by himself. He was probably, you know, at the time of the Irish genocide, the potato famine, it was one person often coming, and who right. survived the whole family. And so that's my lineage, is already from, you know, 100 years ago, that one, you know, that individuation. And we're so far from that, those of us who've been here a while. It's quite like we don't even know what we've lost often, I think. So yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's just so I think it's helpful because it starts to help us piece together, you know, to recognize, like, well, one, just the empathy of like, wow, like I even though I've known you for so long, I didn't know the details of like what you've been through, you know, and then also just to really understand the global situation, our personal place in it, like to really understand what we have lost and the grief that really we're all walking with and need to acknowledge and recognize as being a part of humanity at this time. So thank you so much. Yeah,
no, thank you for providing this space and share. And I would say that, you know, for anybody who wants to, you know, anybody who wants to know, okay, what can we do? I would say, you know, listen to the stories of the people and allow them to tell the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just hearing the story is helpful, you think? Just have it. Yeah.
It does. It is. Yeah. Because a lot of people come here and it's kind of like do, find a job, find a house, find this, find, you know, but there's never that space where they, okay, let's settle and let's have somebody to actually listen to the story and how it is for me, you know, to move from one place to the other. Sometimes they don't listen to their own stories.
Yeah, because as you know, so you say the do, it's like we start to lose our humanity in that, you know, survival functioning, right? We start to lose that depth and that humanity. And when we can settle into the story, it just feels so profound and so connective. Like I feel so much more connected to you now that I know this part of your story also, and or really your story. Yeah. So
thank you
so much. And yeah, you are working with the Work That Reconnects Network, Gaia Education, and the Capra Course by Fritjof Capra, which are all incredible organizations to check out, particularly, I'm not so familiar with the Capra course, but I know the work that reconnects, as you know, is part of my work as well. The Truth Mandala comes from Joanna Macy and Gaia Education as well. Do you want to say just a little bit about, because I know that this is the work that you do now that like actually helps people get connected to that primary mother, right? Our primary connection with the earth.
Yeah. Well, the three jobs emerged from my concern, you know, for the things that were happening in the world. Like I say, you know, I didn't look for them. They kind of came to me because I started as a student first, and that's how I found them. So I'm going to start with the one that you are not so familiar with, and it's Fritjof Capra. Fritjof Capra wrote a book many years ago, about 50 years ago or 40 years ago, called The Turning Point. And he's a physicist. But he comes with this vision of when the physics, you know, the science, you know, that started to change, as, you know, as a result of the encounter with the Eastern ideas, you know, and philosophies. And he actually left physics and started writing these books and exploring what is called systems thinking. So he's one of the major authors who have, you know, explored and, you know, and wrote about and teaching about system thinking, right? Which is actually one of the basis of the world where the reconnects, you know, the recognizing that everything is a system and recognizing how systems interact. So I took the Capra course with him in 2016, the first time that he launched as an online course. In 2021, I had the luck to start working with him. He's 85 years old right now, so it's probably the last, you know, the last few years that he's doing this, but he's very still, you know, himself. So yeah. For me, it's a home, you know, it's such an honor to work with him on this course. So it's very connected. So I am really, really privileged that my three jobs, Gaia Education is also, you know, the courses are on awareness and also tools how to make change in the world. And while you're familiar with the word, the Reconnect. So the three institutions are both run in a way that represents, like, walks the talk, you know, what they are teaching or spreading in the world. So for me, working for these three organizations is such a, you know, it's such a privilege. And, you know, sometimes I like, I am really working for them. Right? And I'm also working from home, which means that, you know, I have this flexibility of meeting with you right now in the middle of the day, you know, in a Friday. Okay. Yeah, so I kind of crafted this for myself because I wanted something like that, but at the same time it emerged. So I think that thing of, you know, follow your dreams and, you know, and really go into the things that you want, and the things that you believe, in many ways really manifest opportunities. And we had to be very careful with that idea because it manifests if you are in a position of privilege, right? Yeah. So it's not everybody has that experience that things manifest for them just because they are
dreaming, you know, getting kind of, yeah,
exactly. So we had to be very careful, and those who have the privilege to experience that luck, because I think it's luck, you know, that we get into that, we also have the responsibility to open the doors for those who may not have that experience.
Yeah, 100%. No, I so agree with you. Yeah, and I think that's such an important awareness, because there can be, like, you know, this whole, like, law of attraction, whatever, the secret world of manifestation, it can easily breed this, like, kind of very toxic idea that, like, if people are having a hard time, it's because they're not in alignment. Whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, we also really have to recognize the privilege and the world, you know, the very unfair hierarchy of, you know, who gets access to the opportunity and who doesn't. And I really, we have that responsibility to then, you know, both step forward and fully serve in our gifts when we have the privilege to be able to do that, and then also see how we can help those who are less privileged. And yeah, so thank you so much.
For you're welcome. Thank you, Josiah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This has been Through the Dark Woods podcast. I'm your host, Josiah Tamira Crossley, and thanks for listening today. If you are looking for support to process your own grief or would like to learn more about trainings to support others, check out darkwoodsofgrief.com.